The following program deals with military and veteran issues. All comments and opinions expressed on this show are those who made them. They do not reflect the opinions of the Church of Satan or Radio Free Satan. So on with the show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the official Inferno Legion podcast for the month of March, the pandemic special episode. We are all socially distancing via Skype at the moment.
and keeping ourselves safe and healthy.
Unlike normal, I'm not going to catch up with my guys here, but I do want to point out that with me as always is my wonderful co-host, Satanist Dwayne Burns, and our benevolent producer, Warlock Jeffrey Ivins. Gentlemen, thank you so much for doing this. We're going to jump right into our Wicked Warrior of the Month interview with a man that I have been trying to get on this program since we started this program. you probably know him, I'm sure, because we all have the same listening base. He is Reverend Adam Campbell, the host of shows such as Speak of the Devil, 9 Cents, and several others. Welcome to the show, Adam. How are you, man?
I'm great. Thank you, gentlemen, for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, man. Thank you for being here. So I want to jump right into this. Let's go back many, many moons ago to when you were a young man and decided that you were going to sell your soul to the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
What led you to that decision?
I was living in a duplex with a bunch of druggy friends. Most of them older than me, and I was looking at them as my future, and I already knew that my parents were not going to help me with college, and if I ever wanted to go to college, which was the only way I was going to get out of this druggy duplex, I would need to go in the military in order to get the GI Bill and do it. And so I realized that I could not live this lifestyle anymore if I wanted to live, and that meant going into the military in this Operation Desert Shield time, where I was hoping would be a nice window of not having any conflict, which ended up working perfectly in my particular case up until 9/11. So I went in to escape the life situation I had found myself in, and I ended up living with my parents while I was going through processing and everything, and even testing, and that was a chore because they're Mormon. And so, like, I got married to my wife, I signed up for the military, and I shipped out, and my enrollment date was actually April 1st, of course. So.
Nice.
It did wonderful things because you are a brilliantly intelligent man, so did good things.
I don't think we can blame that on the military.
No, I'm talking about the college afterwards.
Yeah. No, it was great. And it was funny because even just recently, my son is graduating early because they canceled all the schools and stuff, and he already had credits and stuff. But I was telling him, I was like, you're doing an amazing job graduating with such great grades. I'm so proud of you. And he was like, I thought you graduated with straight A's. I was like, no, that was college. I almost flunked out of high school. The only time I cared about my education was in college, and that's when I made sure it worked to my advantage. So
I had to get my high school diploma. I had to go to basic training to get my high school diploma.
Yeah.
I did. It was one of my conditions of graduating basic training and going to AIT. Mm-hmm. You don't get your damn diploma, you're a holdover.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they'll hang on to you for a while, too. All right, so you had, at the time, 5 branches to choose from. What made you decide on the Army?
They chose me. So I wanted to go into... Okay, so this is going to sound really stupid, but just understand, I'm a sort of ridiculous person. I watched Independence Day maybe a billion times, and so I wanted to be a pilot in the Air Force. Like, that was my goal. I wanted to be Will Smith. I wasn't going to dye the skin in public, but I wanted to be a Will Smith. And so I tried to go into the Air Force. They accepted me through all my testing, and they said that, you know, they could only use me as a mechanic because, again, almost flunked out of high school. And so I was still willing to do it. And then when I was getting my physical, the doctor noticed my sigil of Baphomet tattoo on my back. And he stopped the examination, and he walked out, and he came back in with an officer, an Air Force officer, and said, "Is that okay to have?" And he said, "Why do you have the Goat of Mendez on your back?" And I said, "How do you know about the Goat of Mendez?" I said, "It's just a religious symbol. It's not a, you know, I identified as a Satanist for years before this, in 2 years. It's my religion." And there's another gentleman, a Latin gentleman, who had a huge cross on his forearm, which was visible. Mine was on my back, not visible. And so I didn't think anything of it. And he said, "Well, we're going to have to take photos of your tattoos in order to make sure that they're approved." And I was like, that doesn't make any sense at all, because there's no regulations at this point against any tattoos, let alone forearm visible tattoos, let alone religious tattoos. I mean, I'm in America. There's freedom of religious liberty, I thought.
I'm sorry, I thought this was America.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense at all. But I let them take photos. I had a whole bunch of satanic-themed tattoos at that time. And so they sent them off. I was going to be going to training in Texas. They sent them off to the battalion commander there, who examined them for a couple hours, maybe probably took one glance at them for a second. And then I got a report saying that they were going to be instituting a family-friendly regulation for tattoos in the near future. And because of that, they did not want to let me in. So I had done everything up until this point. I was going through the physical, which is the last step before I, you know, swore an oath and joined service to go shipped off to whatever their version of boot camp would be. And they flat out rejected me on religious terms.
For a standard they hadn't even written yet.
Exactly. And so I went back home. I was living with my parents at the time. And my stepdad, who was a retired captain in the Army, said, "Well, look, reach out to the ACLU. That's bullshit. There's no reason why they could have rejected you." And I was forced in this position of making that decision of, did I want to be a representative of discrimination? It could just end up being local, or it could be much larger than that. Or did I want to go on with my life and build my life? And I chose building my life instead. I said, "Look, I don't want to be a poster boy for religious liberty. I definitely don't want to put Satanism in that light either, because, quite frankly, I don't think anyone should use their religion, and certainly not a Satanist, as just cause for any life choice. It's supposed to be a personal thing, and that's how I understood it then. That's how I understand it now. And so instead, I just said, maybe I'll go do something else, and I'll figure out another way." And my stepdad was like, "You need to go into the Army, because they don't care." Like, "Are you sure?" And so I went back down to MEPS, and the Army guy was like, "We'll take anyone, and you are anyone, so please consider us."
As long as your tattoos ain't on your face or on your hands, we don't give a shit.
Yeah, and they didn't say anything about the ink. They didn't complain at all. They signed me up for an oath, and I was shipped off. And the rest is history. Yeah.
Right on. So did they give you then your military occupation especially, or did they still let you have the opportunity to choose one?
They gave me many more choices than the Air Force did, actually. And I ended up choosing Signal Corps because I was hoping that I would learn something that I could then apply in
schooling. Georgia.
Exactly. I had good times in Georgia.
I had some good times.
Based on your podcasting and things like that, I'd imagine that you learned a little bit in the Signal Corps, at least.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the truth is my MOS, which is 31 Uniform, went through a whole bunch of different shifts with you too.
It was 31 kilo at the time, right, when I went in.
There was a lot of merging with different MOSs and communications, yeah, at that time, because computers were coming out and being, you know, very popularized in the military. And so, I mean, it was still like Windows 95 days or Windows, yeah, 3.1 before that in most places.
Well, when I went DOS.
Yeah.
When I went through 31 kilo / 31 uniform, My class was the very first class to do MSE. They had just brought MSE out. And, you know, we completed the whole 31-kilo course and asked for volunteers to stay behind to learn MSE. I said, fuck, I'll learn anything you'll teach me. anything you'll teach me is going to advance me. I went in at the age of 17, was an E5 by the time I was 19. I mean, I learned anything they taught me.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever really thought about how difficult being in communications in the military would be with the ever-changing dynamic of technology, especially communications technology. But now that you guys are both talking about it, I'm like, well, shit, that makes a lot of sense. Your AIT isn't even going to resemble the guy who came in 4 years after your AIT.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's almost like computer technology. You go out and buy a computer today, and they've already got one that they're building that in 6 months your shit's going to be obsolete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we had to build computers from components, which, if anyone's done it, it's not a big deal, but that was part of the training. And so one of my vivid memories of being in AIT, your Advanced Individual Training for the audience, you guys probably already know.
Right.
Considering the audience. But my early memories was searching satanic websites. And this was 1997. If memory serves, this is late 1997, and so it was like those fiery pentagram spinning GIFs and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Angel Fire.
Yeah, a lot of GeoCities and Angel Fire stuff. Yeah, and that was my first exposure to Satanism online, was that type of satanic online expression, which was just ridiculous, and it kept me away from it for a long time.
Yeah, there's parts of the aesthetic that are certainly appealing, and there's parts of it that are like... but all right, so how long was your AIT?
Oh, geez. I mean, this was like 18 years ago, so I'm trying to remember. I was...
10 or 11 weeks.
Yeah.
I think, because if he... I mean, I had to do... And I'm sure mine was different than his. I did mine in 89. We were doing switchboards, like your operators with the switchboards, pull the cord, put it in the socket so that you can put a call through.
You had to put your hair in a nice bun and chew gum while you're...
somebody's calling, light flicks on, you gotta pull the cord. And, you know, we were learning Syngars, which I'm sure they still had you on Syngars then.
Syngars lasted all the way up to my era.
I can remember falling asleep once in class, and they took the damn cord from the switchboard and put it down the back of my shirt and cranked on that bitch, and I got a real nice smudge of shock.
And now you wonder how you got back problems.
Well, it's clearly not the Army's fault.
No, definitely not.
All right, so let me ask you this then. I want to go back to basic training, but before we get there, when you graduated AIT and you left and you went to your first unit, did you feel like AIT had actually prepared you for anything you were going to be doing on a daily basis?
Fuck no. No. I mean, we had to learn all of the communication equipment in 11 weeks that had been used and is still out there being used, plus everything that they're going to be having. Mm-hmm. And so because you had such a wide range, you had no idea what your final duty station was going to
have. And the shit from 30 years ago in Vietnam. People running around with a prick on their back. Yeah. You know?
So you walk out of AIT and you feel like you've learned all this stuff and it's all in here, and you get to your unit and you realize you're still just a dumb private.
and you make the mistake of telling the platoon sergeant that you know all the new shit and you're going to teach him how to do stuff.
My first duty station was a cavalry unit that was trainee for officers. And so it was not a stressful environment. Everyone was very cool and relaxed and let me sort of find my own place. So it was actually really nice once I got there, but getting there was very stressful because I didn't feel like I was... I left knowing what I was trained in, but I also knew that that wasn't enough to actually let me know how to take over a shop once I got there, which ended up was what was happening. I had never actually worked in a shop from my private status to my sergeant status of ever having someone over me. I was always thrown into a unit where someone was phased out and they had to find someone to take over someone else's position. And so getting in totally green with a bunch of staff sergeants who are leaving, and I'm supposed to just read their paperwork and know exactly what the hell's going on and pick the ball up from where they left, when they had M1A1 tanks that I was supposed to be servicing that I'd never seen the communication with. And not all use the same technology. Like, some was way outdated, some was newer. And so, because they had to, of course, teach the officers the same spread of technology that they taught me. And it was a nightmare. It was a total nightmare. But everyone was really cool and sort of worked with me. And I'm good enough to bullshit most people most of the time.
Right. And that's, you know, that's the key when you're dealing with officers is bullshitting. As long as you can convince them you know what you're talking about, you're good to go.
I like looking at an MDO.
And they keep you real close to you. Keep you real close. Yeah, sir, do you know what's going on here? Help me out.
They'll call someone like, oh, this is my guy, until someone informs them, like, he's bullshitting you. He doesn't know anything.
But I was fortunate enough to not be around anyone who knew that I was bullshitting.
Right.
And so I just... No, I mean, it ended up being really, really a good place, and especially for my type of a personality, where I just sort of sassed back to people. Like, whether you're an officer or not, I take people for who they are and how they present themselves, not by what they wore on their collar. And most of the green lieutenants and captains were okay with that because, again, like to your point, they, you know, pulled me in and said, hey, I need you to help me out here. Tell me what to do. I would. And so because I could bullshit them, they afforded me a certain bit of behavioral string, you know, to act with. And it ended up being really great. I mean, you know, I would bring my metal music to the office and no one would bitch. I would, I had nipple ring in the whole time. And officers would tell me, Private Campbell, are you wearing a goddamn nipple ring? I was like, yeah, of course. It's like, get that piece of metal out of your fucking body. That belongs to the government. That doesn't belong to you. I was like, I appreciate it. I respect your position, sir, but no. I went through a lot to get this fucking in my nipple. I went through my entire military service with a nipple ring with multiple people telling me to remove it, and I just refused. I'm like, what are they going to do, grab me?
Did the nipple rings affect your PT at all?
No.
Okay. I know when I was doing PT, especially on the test, they would always demand that you like bounce off the ground. I don't know how that'd be if you had nipple rings and you're just bouncing off the ground.
And it was healed years before I ever went in, so it wasn't an issue at all. But, you know, it was one of those things where if you go into the military expecting to talk shit and not be able to produce any goods, then you're going to be fucked. But if you can bring the goods, if you can deliver on whatever deadline they set out for you, and you show them respect in public, you can talk shit all you want in private. And they're generally pretty cool about it.
Yeah.
You were saying you had better luck with the green lieutenants and captains. Mm. I had better luck with the senior NCOs and like the battalion commander. I could go fuck around with them, and they'd bullshit with me all the time.
Nice.
I had a sweet spot of like battery commander level, like so, like the unit XOs and battery commanders. I was really cool with. But the NCOs despised me, and everyone higher than them didn't know I existed. So but that was, you know,
like any of the AIT training. I know we were going to be jumping back to basic training.
Sure.
But like, I never hid that I was a Satanist in my military service. And so like, my first experience of going to AIT training is you have to go through a bunch of classes to learn, you know, everyone to that supports your, you know, your classes and stuff. And so we went and had a chaplain visit, and the chaplain told us all the different religions that they supported. And they asked if there was any other religions that were represented by the soldiers that they didn't speak of. And I rose my hand. I was like, yeah, I'm a Satanist. And he was like, and he was just dumbfounded. Like, I just fucking dumb with the power of Satan. Like, he just had no idea. He was like, is that real? I'm going to have to look up that and get back to you. But what it did is it positioned me against virtually every instructor and every student, but it was also enough of a draw that not only did they fear me so they didn't fuck with me, and those that did fuck with me, it aligned me with the other denigrated religious people. So I had Muslims instructors coming up and saying, look, I understand what it's like to, you know, be in a religion that is not publicly accepted, because again, the there's a bunch of bombings and stuff, and Kaczynski, you know, people were claiming he was a Satanist and stuff back in the day, and there's a lot of ignorance around that. And so my instructors were telling me that that's what I was, and I was like, no, that's not what it is at all. And I wasn't trying to proselytize. I wasn't trying to convert anyone. I was just saying, this is what I am. You legally have to respect it and don't fucking talk to me about it. Right. And they didn't like that I would stand up for myself. They didn't like that I was something different, because we're all supposed to be a nameless, faceless group of, you know, students. And it ended up where in that training unit, you know, I had multiple drill instructors and general instructors standing up for me and saying, look, stop fucking around with him or we're going to report you and you're going to get removed from duty, you know, or bumped down in rank because you're not
going to have an IG complaint.
Yeah. And I made sure that I never complained. I never stood out and made a fuss. I did everything under the table because I didn't want to, again, I didn't want to be a poster child. I just wanted what was fucking right. And that's it.
Right.
So,
well, it goes back to what you were saying a minute ago about if you can deliver the goods in the military, people don't fuck with you. And that's the case in general with everything from religion to like weird sexual proclivities and things like that. Like, there are very few people who were booted out during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell era for being homosexual, yeah, because they were homosexual and the commander didn't like that. Right. It was an excuse to get rid of a shitbag soldier.
Yep.
Right.
There's always going to be cases that don't go with that. But I know plenty of gay guys when I was in my unit that were squared away, got their work done, and nobody fucked with them ever. Mm-hmm. And then we had one or two that ended up, you know, getting their other than honorable, because they were shitbags, and that was a perfect excuse for the commander to get rid of them.
Yeah, my first sergeant in my second duty station in Germany, she was openly bisexual, but she was in a relationship with a female. There was the barrack girls. There were groups of lesbians that just sort of all, you know, hung together and had parties, and the guys would watch sometimes, and they'd, you know, send out videos and photos and stuff. And, you know, sometimes they would get verbally reprimanded by the platoon sergeants or the first sergeant or something, but it was never anything big enough in order to eject them from service, simply because our leaders also were homosexual. And so, like, that whole mentality, you know, as a civilian side and a sort of cultural side of, you shouldn't have any gay people or trans people in the military, bitch, they've been there from the beginning. Yeah. They've always been there. And the military's known that they've been there. So fucking get off the fucking soapbox, you bigoted piece of shit. Like, it doesn't make sense.
No, I agree with you. I've never had any, and I was happy to see that they finally got rid of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell order and just, you know, said what we've been saying all along. It doesn't fucking matter.
Your job, that's all that matters.
Because that's really what it comes down to in the military. Like, people, I don't think a lot of civilians really understand the military mindset of it has to get done.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how it gets done. It has to get done. Mm-hmm. And so they need everybody to, you know, tug on their ball sack and get to fucking work.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so let's go back to basic training. Everyone's favorite time in basic training, the shark attack. Was this, you said your father was retired captain from the Army. Yeah. Were you expecting any of this, or when the shark attack happened, did it blow your mind?
I don't understand what you mean by shark attack.
Well, the first day when they line you up on the drill pad and they start dumping your stuff out and smoking out of you. And
No, I mean... It wasn't even really like that. I mean, we were in reception, and the drill instructors came in and chose us, and denigrated the people that they clearly didn't want, and then they bust us over to the camp. I was in South Carolina, and they just had us line up in this big group and then throw our gear upstairs, and it started. It was just on. Like, there was never, like, a big theatrical thing.
Well, maybe that's why they call it Relaxin' Jackson.
Yeah. we went through, they had us, whether you had any contraband on you or not, they made you take all your bags, walk through the amnesty room. If you had anything to get rid of, no questions asked. If you brought in a rocket launcher, no questions asked. Drop it in the fucking amnesty room and move along. But that is where you dumped your shit out and got rid of what you shouldn't have. But whether you had something or not, you walked through the amnesty room, and that was your one time. And then, like he, like Adam said, they just took your shit and threw it in a room, and you didn't get it back till week four of AIT.
Wow. They figuratively beat the shit out of us for 12 hours straight, and then started training. But, all right, yeah, that's cool. But so basic training is an intense moment in anyone's life. Mm-hmm. They're trying to cram, you know, thousands of years of soldier knowledge into your head in a very short time period and enforce respect and discipline and things like that along the way. So was there any moment in basic training where you felt like I fucked up, like I shouldn't be here? Or was it all pretty straightforward for you?
So there's a couple of things. I was smoking before I went in, and so I had withdrawals of not being able to smoke, and so that was very, very difficult for me. And that was the moments where I was like, I fucked up. I need to get out. And I was like, you know, I think I got a phone call at some point in reception, I think, or maybe, I can't remember at this point, but I had communicated to my parents. I was like, please, whatever you can do, get me out. Like, I need to come home. And they replied at some point saying, look, if you really want to get out, you know, we'll figure something out. And I just thought about it for a second. I was like, you know what? No, this is my future. I got to embrace this. Even I got to embrace the shit. I've just got to embrace it. Embrace the suck, as we used to call it.
Right, right.
And so I just sort of buckled that part of it down. I was primed before I went in because my stepdad was a captain, retired. He had told me going in, and I was a D&D and video game nerd before I went in. And right. So he was like, look, you pretend to be all these other people every day when you're playing with your friends. Pretend to be a soldier and just do that for 5 years or 4 years, he said. But do it for 4 years, and that's it. And
that's brilliant advice.
Yeah, if you can do that, then you're going to end up on the other side of the college education. And so as soon as I made that choice in reception, I think it was, where I was like, you know what, I'm just going to accept it. I'm just going to deal with it. I can do this for 4 years. That's nothing. I can do it. Then I did. And it ended up being the best fucking advice I'd ever received in my life.
So you had mentioned about Satanism. You discovered Satanism before you went into the military. During basic training, at least for me, and I've told this story numerous times, but on Sundays, I would usually go to the, like, I think I went to the Mormon service the entire time, because the drill sergeants had a simple rule. It was like, you go to church or you belong to us for the day.
Yep.
Did you ever go explore any other religious services during basic, or did you just stay and roll the dice?
No, I saw it as if they don't want to respect and appreciate the immensity of the relevancy of our religion to the military, because I think it relates very, very well, personally. But if they don't want to respect that or understand it, then I'll just fucking clean the bay. I don't care. Like, there's a bunch of dudes who didn't go to service, and so we all just hung out, and it ended up being a place where...
In 1966... Anton LaVey created the Church of Satan, marking the beginning of the Age of Fire and Year One Anno Satanas. In 1969, he published The Satanic Bible, codifying Satanism as a religion, the first time it's been done in human history.
In the name of Satan, ruler of the earth, king of hell, come forth from the pit, bestow the blessings of hell upon us. For we are your children, and we invoke thee this night.
In 2001, I was appointed High Priest of the Church of Satan. In 2007, I published the Satanic Scriptures, further defining and expanding on Satanic philosophy and greater magic ritual.
Hail Satan, full of might! Our allegiance is with thee. Cursed are they. The God adorers. And cursed are the worshippers of the Nazarene eunuch.
For the past 50 years, the Church of Satan has stood as the sole organization to define and defend Satanism as a religion. And though pretenders to the infernal throne have come and gone, we have stood the test of time and will into the future. Visit churchofsatan.com for more information and read the Satanic Bible and the Satanic Scriptures. Knowledge is the solution for ignorance. Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Take a trip back to the 1980s with me, Warlock Jeff Ivins, on the Metro Radio Free Satan's show, highlighting the new wave and other hits from the indulgent decade, only on RadioFreeSatan.com.
This is Reverend Gene, the host of Vox Satane, exclusively on Radio Free Satan. Join me every week as we indulge in the classical side of music spanning the past 1,000 years. Vox Satane has already featured over 700 composers covering medieval, baroque, classical, romantic, and contemporary music, including chant, choral, opera, keyboard, and orchestral music, with composers ranging from Gluck to Gilmour, Bach to Bellavance, Talis to Taverner, and Paganini to Pärt. Get your weekly recommended dose of classical music right here on Vox Satane, only on Radio Free Satan, with me, Reverend Gene. Hail Satan.
One, my drill instructor, like, immediately came in, and, you know, they were asking what our religious preferences were, and I told him I was a Satanist, and he was like, "You need Jesus, boy!" You know, and laughing and stuff. But he was like, "Come here." And so I walked with him over to the female bay that was right across from the male bay, and he was like, "See this door? I want this to be a mural to Dante's Inferno. I want this to be the gate of hell. And can you paint that for me?" And I was like, "I don't know if I'm going to be here long enough for that, because it's only basic training, right? But I would love to start it. I love the idea." And so from that moment, he and I had a really great connection. And there was a couple things that happened during my service, during my basic training experience, that just endeared us to each other all the more. So, like, he said, "Look, if you don't have the time, and I understand, because you're training, to paint a mural on this wall, then will you at least..." Do we lose him?
No, I think he just cut his video.
"Then will you at least paint a mural on the floor?" And I was like, "Well, fuck yeah, I'll paint a mural on the floor." And so I did this huge, like, we were like the Delta Dogs or something like that. And so I did all these, like, humanoid dog, you know, warriors, like, murdering their friends on spikes and blood and gore. And I had a quote from the Satanic Bible underneath it. I can't remember the exact verse, but it was, you know, "Death to the weak, wealth to the strong," one. And so I had done that, and that became this infamous mural for classes to come, where people, whoever stepped on it, they would break their leg in some way, or they would have some bad incident occur to them, and it just became this fable that I would hear for the rest of my service, of people talking about, you know, because I was in the Signal Corps, so everyone, you know, went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, would come up to me like, "Oh my gosh, did you hear about that?" I was like, "I did that! I did that! That was me!" Like, holy shit, I can't believe it's still there.
Yeah, that's one thing. I mean, philosophy aside, because I completely agree with you, the philosophy of Satanism lends itself very well to the philosophy of the military. But just aesthetically speaking, NCOs love that kind of shit. You know, anything with, like, death and gore and blood and satanic kind of imagery. And not that that's, you know, what all Satanists subscribe to aesthetically, but that kind of general idea is something that's adored by the military and always has been.
Yeah. I mean, it's a murdering institution.
Right, yeah. At the end of the day, we all have one job.
Yeah.
Exactly. So let's jump into Satanism. You said you discovered it before the military. How old were you when you first read the Satanic Book?
When I first read it, I was in, I think I was a sophomore. So it was very beginning. I'd heard about it in seventh grade, and it sort of just loomed over me for years. And then I bought a copy. I think it was the first year in high school, I think like 10th grade or something like that, where I picked it up, read it, and I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah. I didn't fully understand it, to be fair. I read it, didn't fully understand it, but I love the aesthetics. I love the idea of hell and Satan and the whole mythology behind a Christian version of the fallen Satan. And because my parents were Mormon, they still adhered to that sort of Old Testament myth. And so I immediately connected with the ideology behind the metaphor. I didn't connect with the metaphor until a couple of years later before my military service, so much so that even when I was in the military, I was spreading some pretty bullshit information, unfortunately. You know, I was kind of embarrassed about it.
When did you join the Church of Satan?
It was my first duty station, Fort Gordon, Georgia. Fort Knox, Kentucky. In 1998, I want to say. I think it was 1998, maybe 1997.
Okay. So you were already out of training and all that stuff.
I was in my first duty station when I joined. But I'd self-identified, not fully understanding for a number of years. Once I fully understood, then I joined. And that's really how it came to be.
Well, that's a good way to do it, for sure.
What was your joke?
What was my joke?
Yeah, what was your joke?
Embarrassed about my joke.
It can't be worse than Dwayne's.
No, it cannot be worse than Dwayne's.
Shut the fuck up about my joke.
All right, you gotta tell me your joke after I tell you mine, right? It's so fucking dumb. I feel so stupid saying it. Okay, it was a man walks into a bar, and the bartender says, "Why the fuck did you do that?" That's it. What was it? And I was just like,
if you remember, you were doing one of your shows once, and it was just after we had recorded, and I had talked to Peggy, and I said, we're going around finding out what everybody's jokes are on their application. She goes, that would be a great book to write. Mm-hmm. You know, you chronicleize it over the years. You know, the older Satanists like Neil and stuff, you know, 70 years old, you know, to the younger Satanists. You know, find out how humor's progressed over the years. That could be a great book. So I remember during one of your shows that you were doing, I typed on the screen, I said, so what was your satanic joke for your application? And Adam goes, we'll get to that another time.
Yeah, because I was like, I don't want to fucking tell people.
We'll get to that another time, Dwayne, but thank you for your concern.
So, Dwayne, quit beating around the bush. Tell me your joke.
Tell me your joke.
Fuck yourself. Jesus saves. Get it?
So your joke wasn't as dumb as Dwayne's.
Fuck you guys.
So, besides whatever issues you may have had dealing with higher ranking individuals, and you know, because you already kind of described how those came up, how those got resolved. Right. How did identifying as a Satanist personally impact your military service?
It made it easier for me, I think, because it did create this mystique around me where people, if I spoke about something, felt like there was some sort of infernal knowledge behind it. And so some ancient wisdom, and so they just listened more, or at least pretended to in my presence. So I was always in a leadership position. I always had soldiers who generally, when I was around, would do exactly as I asked, in part, of course, because I'm a higher rank than them, but also because they're afraid of what I'm going to do if I didn't.
smoking has a whole.
Are you going to cast a spell on them, Adam?
Oh my gosh! I had a ritual experience in my first duty station with a whole bunch of other soldiers that was it was all bullshit, but it was fantastic. They all thought I stole their soul. I mean, it was a huge thing. It was great because I love the theatrics of Satanism, and right. So I use that to my own benefit. From AIT to my duty stations, then on out, it was really really great. So I would say that Satanism lent me the idea of individualism. The whole time I was playing a role. I was playing Sergeant Campbell. I wasn't. I don't like the idea of being responsible for other people. I want to be responsible for me and mine. And my whole point of doing all this was so I could go have a future. And so that Satanism was this sort of shield that was underneath everything that I wore. It was underneath my BDUs that was constantly reminding and reinforcing me of what I was doing. I was building a future so that I could have real world accomplishment and be a powerful authoritative Satanist, whatever that means to you as the listener.
So fast forward to the end of your military career.
I got that.
Oh yeah, by all means.
How much time do we have? I don't want to.
We got as much time as you need.
We got as much time as we need. I'm retired.
Sometimes these shows go from like 45 minutes to an hour and a half to 2 hours. So it just depends.
No, I had some great experience. So in basic training, going back to that, there was, I would of course share thoughts because I was outed, by myself, my own admission, the first night. So people would come up to me and ask me about it. And so on some of those Sundays, when everyone else went off to, learn about their Christian gods, I would have three or four boys and girls sitting around me asking me questions. And so I had my wife ship me over satanic Bibles, and I would give them to different people who I thought actually were really interested and not just pretending it. And then I just talked to people about Satanism. It was, again, if I could do it over again, I wouldn't. But because some of the information I shared was not accurate, my intention was to clarify misconceptions, though, and that I did do to the best of my ability. And it was nice to be able to connect with people on a level other than the military. And I learned quickly to hide that I was a role player because I what role players are like my friends. We partied, and then we'd get we had like garage bands, and we'd have girls over, and we'd drink and smoke, and do drugs and just have like a fucking party. And then when it was all dying down, we'd break out D&D and just kind of cheat with the girls and drink. When I went in the military, I realized that's not how everyone played D&D. And so I just hit it. I because as soon as they came up, they're like, "Wow, a character with a 30 plus blah blah blah." I was like, "What the fuck are you talking about?"
and I'm gonna draw that character up now, and we're gonna submit that and play it right now in this new game.
Yeah.
By the way, if you have this kind of armor, here's a piece of armor you have to wear.
Yeah, I couldn't handle that. So I hit it all, and I just kind of avoided it for my service and focused instead on, my point was that Satanism, it drew people to me, it allowed me to clear up misconceptions that a lot of people had about Satanism in general, and then I used it as a form of self-entertainment. As people were inevitably drawn to me, I would just sort of use it against them and manipulate them with lesser magic, and it ended up benefiting me really, really well. I had one guy who was just devoted to me releasing these ancient secrets to him that didn't exist. And he didn't
tell us you were in the Illuminati as well.
It was so great. So I lived off base, and so I would bring people to my, during AIT, because my wife was there. We had an apartment in Augusta, Georgia, and so we would bring other soldiers that I deemed worthy to my place. We'd drink and party and have fun. I'd bring out my Ouija board, which is on my shelf behind me, and just have them cut open themselves, bleed all over it, because that's what we had to do, charge the board. Yeah. We would just have these wonderful, Ouija board ghost experiences that they would remember for the rest of their fucking lives and go and spread this mythology of Private Campbell and his satanic,
It was great.
Did you ever run into, as you were moving around from duty station to duty station, did you ever run into someone who had heard about you before you got there?
No, no. The closest I was the paint mural.
Yeah.
They told me about it as if it was a new information to me. I was like, no, I did that. That was really me.
I've got my Baphomet tattooed on my left forearm, so every time my BDUs were rolled up, my sleeves were rolled up, of course, it would show. I got ordered while I was over in Iraq over at Camp Navstar, and anybody who's at Camp Navstar will tell you, because I had to turn it down. But I got ordered to report to the chaplain because there were other people claiming Satanism, mm-hmm. and they wanted to provide us a place of worship and wanted to know when we needed the place. And, you know, Sergeant Burns, would you be interested in leading the congregation? And I'm like, that shit don't work that way.
They're bullshit.
Don't do that. And these people that are saying they're Satanists and need a place are full of shit. And, you know, well, you still got to report to the chaplain and, you know, you got to find out what he wants. It was a clusterfuck.
So did you ever have an opportunity to live in base housing on base?
I had every opportunity. I just never did.
Never did. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, when I first did IT, I did. Yeah, well, that's why I didn't want to do it. I had all my friends who were doing it. But I was with my wife. And so I went to AIT, and that's when she started driving out. So I had a couple weeks of AIT living in the barracks. But then as soon as she got there, I moved off. So
did you ever, in your regular units, did you ever end up, like, partying with any of the guys in the barracks?
We would go to parties, but they were never fully in the barracks because they got too rowdy. Like, you just couldn't. You know, you had... I can't remember what it's called, but the guard duty that was supposed to watch the barracks at night.
CQ.
CQ. Thank you. I mean, I pulled CQ so many goddamn times, but I can't remember the goddamn name for some reason. So they would end up telling us to shut the fuck up and leave. And so, you know, I'd go over there under the pretense of having a few drinks and playing a board game of, like, Risk or something, and then it would just turn into a fucking party, and we'd have to take it elsewhere. So that, like, when I was in Germany, we just started off base and stayed off base. It was too much. People would complain, you know?
Yeah, because you definitely don't want to be trying to get back on base when you're drunk.
And especially with Polizei and like, they're stopping GIs. I've started practicing my going through checkpoints drunk as shit early in my career. Like, in AIT, you know, I'd drive people off base and drive them back on. And so I would be completely irresponsible. Don't drive and drink.
Right.
But responsibly, I would be lit driving back. There was one time when my wife was so drunk that she was, like, puking. And so I stopped. I was on the side of the road. She's puking. A cop pulls up next to us. And he's like, everything okay in here? I'm like, oh, I'm totally fucking drunk. He's like, oh, we're just going back to the base, sir. My wife has the flu. Yeah. And he was like, thank you for your service, son. He drove off. I was just like, oh. If you would have just come out of the car for a second, he would have smelled all the booze in the fucking car. I would have been like, oh. But yeah, I was only bugged once on base when some MPs, some privates that were pulling guard duty at the base entrance in Fort Gordon, they stopped us and they sort of, you know, tried to pull rank and shit, and gave us a little bit of shit. But then we ended up just driving out the back gate, which wasn't manned at all. So I just quiet.
Yeah, I was, you know, when I was first starting my military career, I didn't have many issues getting on and off base because the MPs are soldiers just like us.
Yeah.
So every now and then you run into a dick, but for the most part they're just like, I don't care, go ahead, yep. Do whatever. But when the war really kicked into its next gear, all the MPs ended up moving to combat units being deployed, and they brought in civilian police to man the gates, and they were they gave one guy an open container citation because he had an empty bottle in his trunk.
Oh shit.
So it completely changed the game on how you got off and on base. That's why we all had crash pads off base.
Damn.
you could be like me. I was over in Schofield Barracks over in Hawaii, and I got stopped walking drunk on the base. They fucking stopped me because I was walking on the base drunk, all fucked up. You got some ID there, soldier? Wait a minute.
Well, it was rough because when I went over to Germany, they said you had a 2-drink during lunch rule. You couldn't have over 2 drinks, and so they would do like a glass of wine and a glass of beer. So that's your 2 drinks. But that gets you drunk. And yeah, especially yeah. Germany.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you're constantly coming back drunk. Like, it's just... That's why so many reasons, but that was one of the reasons in Germany specifically where, you know, alcohol became a problem because it was a cultural thing, and we just took it over and ran with it.
Yeah.
It just fucked us up.
So many people headed to track 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so when it came time for you to ETS, to get out of the Army, knowing that you had gone in, you were playing this character the whole time, and you were doing this for your future, did the retention NCO have any kind of sway over you? Did you consider re-enlisting?
Not at that point. I was very clear that I wanted out. Like
he took out his D20 and rolled against intelligence at a -5.
No, it was before I even got to that point. My commander was like, "So, Sergeant Campbell, you're going to stay in for another year because 9/11 just happened, and so they were shutting down MOSs from leaving, and mine was still open at that time." And so he was like, you know, they're shutting down all the MOSs. Do you want to stay and support your country? I'm like, hey, I love my country, but I don't want to be a servant of it anymore. Like, I've done my time. Like, I did my contract. I did an extra year so my wife could join me in Germany. I need to get the fuck out of here. Like, I respect you guys as individuals, and I respect what you're doing for our country, but this is fucked. So, no, I don't want anything to do with this anymore. And then as soon as I got out, and I was in college, I immediately regretted not staying in. And I, for years, even till this day, sometimes I'll have dreams about still being a soldier, or wanting to sign up again. And I tried when I was going to college in Phoenix, Arizona, and it was maybe a year and a half or a year after I had, left the military, and I was still like on, you know, officially on, you know, reserve recall. And, I was like, I called up a recruiting agent. I was like, hey, I think I want to come back. I've developed asthma, but it's controlled. And he was like, sorry, son, you can't come back. And knowing that I couldn't after I had wanted to, all of a sudden, it just threw me into a mad depression. Like, because I had friends who were being sent off to Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm-hmm. People that I knew that I just served with who are like dying, and I'm in fucking school, and this shame and regret was just washing over me, and I dealt with it through alcohol, but that was not a good way of dealing with it. But to this day, I feel an immense amount of shame for not staying in.
Yeah, it's tough.
Wow.
I never realized that. Thanks for sharing. Man, aside from my asthma, I can fire a rifle, I can fire a retran sight, I can serve.
Like, just make sure I have an inhaler and I'm good to go.
Like, that's it. Other than that, fuck.
And, you know, the truth is we have so many kids who don't know shit about shit going to serve, and especially in early Afghanistan and Iraq, losing limbs on a regular fucking basis and just coming back fucking ruined as human beings. That for me to see that and know that I could have helped some of them because I already had training before I was sent off to war. I could have helped, and I didn't. I chose to leave instead. It was rough. It was really rough.
Yeah. So let me ask you the same question I ask everybody who was in when 9/11 happened. How did it impact what you were doing at that moment? Like,
obviously the air on the base changed because security levels went up and all that stuff. But like, how did it affect everything that was going on in your unit? Did you feel like the end was nigh? Like all this peacetime was about to break down, you were about to be deployed?
Well, okay, so I was stationed in Mannheim, Germany. I was pulling CQ duty that day, but in the battalion offices. The battalion command was in the basement, so a captain came up to me and said, Sergeant, I need to talk to you downstairs, and so I told the private that I was pulling CQ with to just stand by and answer the phone until I got back. Went down into the command center, and I saw video footage of the planes hitting the Twin Towers, and they're like, America's been attacked. We need to recall every soldier. I need you to get your battle gear and get ready. And so for me, I immediately knew that we were at war, and I immediately knew that, like, this could be the end. Like, this could literally be it for me. I'm stationed in Germany. Get me on a plane. And in an hour or so, you know, just in a couple hours, I'm in the shit where we need to be to strike back once we figure out who the enemy is, because it was all suggested it was from the Middle East. I just assumed. I was in an MP unit. The Fighting Deuce, 272nd MP Company. And I just assumed that I would go and go to war with them. But we ended up pulling security for months, and then after I had left, then they went off sent off. But yeah, it was, I knew that it would be different. I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know how to communicate to my wife, who lived off base, because she wasn't safe. You know,
yeah.
It was just a situation where I was forced to sit in the stupid fucking room all night, knowing that the world had just changed and there was nothing I could do about it. I got this overwhelming sick sensation, like I wanted to puke. And so I was just sort of holding myself together as much as I could. All of my soldiers were looking to me for an example to reflect off of. And so I was trying to keep it together as much as I could, holding my military bearing, which I had learned to do pretty well. But inside, I was lost. I was fucking lost. Yeah, because what you do in the military is they hammer you so hard. You guys know this, but they hammer you so hard that you just react. You react off of your training. Mm-hmm. You don't think about it. And I wasn't in a reaction position. I was forced to sit in a quiet fucking room all night. And so I was freaking the fuck out, going, I need my fucking M4 with my 203 on top. I need my fucking battle gear. I need to be with my soldiers. I need to be with my unit. Like, I need to do something. And instead, I'm just staring at a fucking phone, and it was torture.
Yeah.
Did you have to make the recall phone calls? Or
no, it usually all disseminated out from the platoons, and so I would make calls to the different companies, and then from there, it would spread out.
How did those calls go?
Everyone knew. Everyone already knew.
Okay, they were already expecting it, basically.
Yeah, I mean, they were watching the news before, you know, just at the same time battalion was, and so as soon as it hit, they already knew the processes in place and recalled all their soldiers on base, and immediately, you know, got all their gear and their soldiers together, ready for whatever. Because we didn't know. There's a lot of German nationals that do not like the military. And so we didn't know if it was, had there were any sleeper cells in Germany that were going to strike out against us. We just didn't know anything. And so because of that, we just acted as if we were going to deploy to war. And so everyone else got to rely on training, which was great for them. Fuckers.
Oh, man. I know you kind of said earlier if you had it to do over again you wouldn't, but like let's take a serious example of that question. If you were today, knowing, if you knew now, or you knew then what you know now, would you still have enlisted and gone through the process?
Yeah, I would have. And I always, with some candor, I always say that the military was shitty, and, you know, when I was in it, I was having a terrible experience, and so when I recount my experience, I'm recounting it from a position of being in it. But again, I'm a healthy man. I can serve right now. Like, today, if I needed to, I could go and serve. I feel the desire
to do so. And I wish I could go back. I want to, if I wasn't so successful in my civilian career, I would want to go in a government position to be stationed next to soldiers, because I have such a fondness for the individual soldiers and their plight, which no fucking civilian understands. And I don't always agree with the mission. I'm getting emotional, sorry. I don't always agree with the mission that's going on, but that idea of service, when I can serve, it's deep in me, and I want to do it. I would totally do it again, and I would stay longer, and I would re-enlist longer, knowing now what I know.
That's, you know, that's something that we don't often talk about on the show, either amongst each other or with our guests when they come on. But let's hit that for a minute, because there, I know there's a lot of us, especially the gentleman right here on this podcast right now, who don't often agree with the way that America uses its military. And yet we all served, we're all proud of our service, and we would all do it again. What is the how do we disconnect the two? And because it's something that a lot of soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines do every day. But like, so how did, let's just start with you, Adam, and then we can work our way around. How did you guys disconnect those two concepts from one another?
Well, on the base level, I was working towards something. I was working towards getting my GI Bill so that I could go and have a career. So that was the first thing I was working for. After that, you know, we talked about it in the Veterans Day special, I think it was, where you're not fighting for the mission as much as you're fighting for your fellow soldiers. You're completing the mission objectives so that your fellow soldiers don't die. You're doing your job to the best of your ability so that the mission can be completed, and so that there are no casualties. So if that means that you have to do the horrible job of killing someone else, you're prepared for that. You train for that. If that means that you just sit on a fucking mountaintop as a retrans station and make sure that you're pulling guard duty so no one can take over your position and you can relay to battalion or from battalion to the soldiers in the field, then that's your role, and it's an important one, and you have to sit there and do it and make sure that it stays up no matter what. And you're ready to die for it because there are other soldiers out there who are in the same shit that you are, who you want to see go home to their families. And I don't believe in self-sacrifice for no fucking reason, there's a lot of people that I would give my life for. If my son, if my daughter, if my wife, and some of my extended family, and some of my friends. If it came down to a situation where I had to put myself out there, then I would do it. I wouldn't be happy about it, but it means that they're going to move on. And that may not be a satanic ideal for some people, but I would have to remind people that Satanists are not Satanism. Satanists are human beings that identify with a religion. We are not solely one thing. We are a multitude of life experiences and ideas that we have crafted for ourselves. Satanism is one thing that we connect with, and there are other morals and values that are taught to us through society, through culture, through upbringing, that are going to also inform who and what we are. And so I don't denigrate Satanists who would say that they would never give their life for anything, or they would never serve because they don't like the idea of dropping bombs on civilians in other countries. That's fine.
Yeah,
but that's not why I served. And I served for me, and so your desire not to is as valid as my desire to.
I think that's a beautiful summation.
I can't really add anything to that.
As always, fucking eloquent.
It just drives me crazy because there's so many assholes out there who look at those who have served who identify as Satanists, and I get it if you're not a Satanist and you don't understand the religion. And then you say, well, how can you as a Satanist, when the Satanic Bible is talking about a life everlasting, world without end, and the individual is the beginning and end of everything, and you know, you're the highest embodiment of human life, you don't sacrifice yourself, you don't commit suicide, how could you as a Satanist ever join a service and give your life? Well, that is such a stupid sentiment, because it not only means that you don't understand the religion, but you don't understand humanity, which the religion is based off of. It's ignoring the entire concept that there is not a paragon of Satan that everyone is working up to. There's not an Anton LaVey Buddha that everyone is trying to emulate. No, you wouldn't know it by some Satanist. We are supposed to be our own fucking gods. And if that means that you protect those that you love, and in the process of that, you're willing to sacrifice for those that you've chosen to love, then that is as satanic as someone who chooses to self-preservation and lie that they're not on that side of the war. They hide that they're Satanist.
You mean I can't get to the next level, like in Scientology?
I'm sure you
can. 63 selfish actions gets you the next. It gets you the purple card.
Yeah.
You guys gotta have the purple card, because that's.
And with all the different colors we have at SatanMe.com, you can get a matching Baphomet as well. Little plug there for you there, Lex.
So let's do the flip side of that. How has being in the military informed your civilian life, and maybe even your understanding of Satanism, if that applies at all?
Well, as far as civilian life goes, it gave me tool. First of all, you get a crash course in lesser magic in the military. Like, there's nothing that is going to teach you to shut up, drop your ego, and learn to work the game faster than basic training. Like, it is just like the best master class you will ever get in, like, perspective and ego. And if you can work through that, then you can literally work through any other fucking situation and game it to your advantage. You get an exposure to so many different types of people in the exact same situation and learn how they act and what they do differently than you, what they've done wrong, what they've done right compared to what you do. Learn their life experience before the military, because you immediately bond with other soldiers faster than anything else. It is literally a crash course in human psychology. And I mean, just sitting through that gas chamber is a fucking psychological warfare test. Like, you're not just examining yourself and dealing with yourself. You've got an entire test case of people to learn from as well. And if you're open to that, then you're going to learn a lot about humanity, and that's only going to aid you in lesser magic. So I would say that's how it informs Satanism for me anyways, lesser magic primarily. But just life lessons, you know, learning how to be a man, how to drop my ego, how to have perspective, how to focus on one task at a time and do it to the best of my ability so I don't have to revisit it. Little things like that.
Forget what you have learned in life and learn a new life in 9 weeks.
Right. Well, I think one big thing the military taught me that I never really had a notion of. No, I've like most people, I was young when I went in, so I didn't really consider this. But one of the biggest things that I've held with me to this day is the after-action review.
Yeah.
Like, so many people don't, they accomplish a task and they just move on to the next thing. But it taught me to sit there and go, like, okay, what did I do here? What went right? What went wrong? Yeah. You know?
What can I do better?
That is so great. That's such a good point. That is such a goddamn good point. I was in my first job after college, in my like career. It was Icon Health and Fitness up in Logan, Utah. And we had done this insane project of getting all these like posters and banners and point-of-purchase displays overnight for a trade show that they had known about for months, but we just found out about that night. So we pulled an all-nighter, getting all this equipment together and designing it all and putting it all together and stuff. And the next day, I told my boss, I was like, look, in the military, we had an after-action review. I would like to talk to you and maybe avoid this again. Right. So that we can learn by examining where the communication lines were broken down, how we can streamline this, because I don't want to stay here overnight again. If I don't have to, I would prefer to learn from our mistakes. And he was like, this isn't the military, Adam. Stop thinking in terms of the military. You are in a fucking graphic designer role. just design what we tell you to design. And I was like, you're missing a fucking life opportunity here.
Right, that can help your entire company.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. But yeah, I didn't remember that until you fucking mentioned that. I think that's a great way to go through life, is because it really all it is it's reflection and digestion of what just happened. Understand, clearing your mind of the insanity of the moment, and then being able to reflect on it and learn something from it. If that's not a key piece of being a Satanist, I don't know what is. You have to be able to learn from your mistakes and understand how you were successful in your successes.
Yeah.
And it helps you identify your own weaknesses. And that's one of the things is, you know, we as Satanists, we throw around a lot of language that inspires us, and most of it we really believe. Yeah. But concepts like strength and might is right and things like that, these are all important concepts, but they're meaningless if you don't know where you're weak.
Yeah.
Because you are, we're all weak somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm weak in joke telling.
You may make it up in the face.
Oh, you bastard.
Well, hell, this has been an absolutely wonderful episode. And so honestly, it's
been an hour.
Yeah, I think I'm going to give you a moment to plug your stuff. You got a whole lot going on, and I know a lot of people like to listen to you. So do your thing.
As many as I would think. That was very arrogant. As many as I expected. I think I've got a kind of a bad reputation out there, but that's okay. Go to reverendcampbell.com if you want to find out any of the things I'm doing, and that's really all you got to do. That's it.
There. I saw that you brought back 9 Cents Podcast. I was very happy to see that.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a different format in that it's just me and there's no contributors to it. But every once in a while, I have a guest to join me. But other than that, I just want something simple. I want to communicate Satanism. I enjoy it. It's fun for me. First of all, I love the religion. And I get to talk with gentlemen like you, who I appreciate as fellow Satanists. And I'm glad that they're out there. You guys are out there doing what you're doing. It's just, it's nice to be able to connect from time to time without having to wait through the fucking idiots online.
Yeah, don't even get started on that. Especially in this climate that we're currently in. All right. Well, it's been absolutely fantastic having you on, Reverend Campbell. Thank you so much for being a part of this. Oh, and I forgot to mention during your intro, thank you so much for designing our logo for the Infernal Legion.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I guess until next month. Actually, no, not next month. We do have a special thing coming up. I don't have a date for it yet. I will make sure that I put that out through all the Infernal Legion channels and networks. But we will have a special thing coming up in the next week, maybe 2 weeks. But until then, until you hear from us next time, thank you for listening, and hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan. Hail Satan. God damn it.